بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، حبيب إله العالمين، أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد، وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المنتجبين. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. إن الله مع الذين اتقوا والذين هم محسنون. صدق الله العلي العظيم، وصلوا على محمد وآل محمد. One of the last sermons that Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam delivered during his lifetime is found in Nahj al-Balagha, sermon number 180. This sermon was delivered before the Imam wanted to leave to Siffin for the second time. The first time that the Imam went to Siffin was in order to fight the battle against Muawiyah, and that ended in a stalemate, an arbitration, which the Imam did not support. People in his army, they turned against him. They said, "We won't fight," because the army of Muawiyah lifted the Qur'ans up on the spears. So they decided to have an arbitration, that they would decide, the people, they would decide amongst themselves who would be the Khalifa. It won't be Amir al-Mu'mineen, it won't be Muawiyah, they'll decide amongst themselves. Now a few loyal people, they stay on the side of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Some of his own people turned against him, they were known as Khawarij. So the Imam, after all of this, after fighting the Battle of Nahrawan, and wanting to go back to Siffin in order to end the arbitration, because it wasn't ending successfully, he stood up and he delivered this sermon. Now this sermon is narrated by those who are close to him. It is said that he stood up on a rock, on a pulpit, which was made of a rock, and he delivered a very powerful sermon to his people. And in his sermon, he was complaining to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And he was telling the people that, "I have sacrificed my life for you, I have sacrificed my energy for you, I have tried my hardest to work with you, but you have committed mutiny against me and you have turned against me." When he stood up in front of the people, and Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen was described in the following way. He was wearing a robe which was made out of wool, the kind of uncomfortable fabric which, you know, scratches against the skin. This was his cloth that he would wear. And his sandals were made out of very, very simple material. And all he had was him with was his sword. And the mark of prostration on his forehead was so deep it looked like the knee of a camel. Have you seen how a camel sits up and down on its knee and how it becomes dug into the ground? This is the mark of prostration on his forehead. So he begins by admonishing his people. And then he tells them, "O people, take the example of the people that came before you. How many people mentioned in the Qur'an, how many groups did Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mention in the Qur'an that were destroyed, completely annihilated? There is no trace of them today. Many tribes in the Qur'an, peoples that he had sent prophets to, that disobeyed the prophets, disobeyed the commands, and as a result of this, Allah annihilated them completely. He destroyed them completely. As a result of their own sinning, as a result of their own disobedience." Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us in the Qur'an that sometimes the torment, the torture, the punishment that we experience collectively is as a result of our collective disobedience to Allah. When a group of people get together and they decide, they unite in disobeying the commands of Allah, Allah will punish them collectively. And that's exactly what happened to Aad, Thamud, Qawm Lut, Ashabul Ayka, Ashabul Ras, these people who are mentioned in the Qur'an, collectively they were punished. Sometimes a few of them were survived, such as in the story of the people of Lut. Lut himself and some of his family members, they were survived from the punishment. They were exempt. Nuh alayhi salam, his people were punished but he was saved. So others were completely annihilated. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he said, look, O people, you insist on your disobedience. You insist on your mutiny. Take the example of the people that came before you. You are no different than them. Is it that because you are, for instance, Arab and they are non-Arab, that makes you special? What is it that makes you special? Nothing. In the same way that he collectively punished these individuals who disobeyed him, he can also do the same to you. And he was saying this to his followers. So as followers, we need to also understand this, that we are not exempt of punishment. If collectively we decide to disobey Allah, if collectively we encourage others to do evil, if collectively one person introduces an evil practice and everyone else practices it, and there is no enjoining that which is good and forbidding that which is evil, we are also prone to punishment. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, He says that ظَهَرَ الْفَسَادُ فِي الْبَرِّ وَالْبَحْرِ بِمَا كَسَبَتْ أَيْدِي النَّاسِ He says that the corruption, the deviation, the destruction that you see on planet Earth, a lot of it is a result of the actions of people. People disobey God, they forget Him, they go against His commands, they sin collectively, and because of that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala punishes a people. Or because of that you find widespread corruption. Now, if you look at our problems as humanity as a whole, both our worldly problems and our social problems, if you look at the social diseases which exist today, hypocrisy, racism, superiority, where does that come from? Does that come from the sky? Does that come from the angels? Or does it come from beneath the ground? Does it come up, pop up from the ocean? Or does it come from us as a society? It comes from us. When you look at other issues which are affecting the world today, they speak about, for instance, global warming. Where does global warming come from? Does it come from God? Does it come from the mountains? Or does it come from us? Most of it, some of it comes from the earth itself, most of it comes from us. Our wastefulness, everything which is affecting the environment today, most of that comes from us, it comes from our own deeds. So the Imam was telling them, look to yourselves, I admonish you, and look to the people that came before you. You are not exempt. You can also follow the same fate as them. And then the Imam continues. The Imam, of course it's a very long sermon, in one part of his sermon towards the end, he reminds people of those that they should walk in the footsteps of. He mentions the names of his companions which he has lost. And when he mentions their name, he begins to weep for them. He says, I had a few people with me. They were the ones who enjoined what is good. They were the ones who forbade that which was evil. They were the ones who would constantly speak the verses of Allah. They are the ones who constantly remembered Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And now they are gone. So as he is saying the sermon, he brings their names. He says, where is Ammar? Speaking of Ammar ibn Yasir. He says, where is Ibn Tayyihan, another companion? He says, where is the Shahadatain, Huzaymah ibn Thabit? These were the men who walked in the footsteps of their prophets, walked in the footsteps of their leaders, but now they are gone. Take their example. The narration says that when he mentioned their names, he could not continue. So he held his beard and he began to weep for his companions. And when he began to weep, this reminds us of a hadith that the Imam himself has said. He says, be in a way, conduct yourself in a way, that when you are alive, people will crave for your company. People want to be around you all of the time when you are alive. And that when you die, people weep over you. Some people, you see them and you never, you know, you don't crave for their company. If they're gone, they can be gone for a year, they can be gone for 5, 10 years, you'll never miss them. And when they die, it does not make any difference to you. The Imam says, be in a way that people crave your company. They long to sit with you. They long to be with you. And if you die, they weep over you. These were his companions. People who I mentioned yesterday and the day before. Abu Dharr al-Ghifari, Salman al-Muhammadi. According to the hadith, the Prophet says that there are four people who the Jannah, the paradise, longs to meet. The paradise waits to meet these people, to accept these people. Ali ibn Abi Talib and three of his companions, Salman al-Muhammadi, Abu Dharr al-Ghifari, and Ammar ibn Yasir. These are the people that the paradise longs for them, waits for them to come so it can accept them. Now, who are these people? A few nights ago we mentioned Abu Dharr al-Ghifari. And yesterday and the day before we mentioned Salman al-Muhammadi. Now I want to mention another great companion, and that is Ammar ibn Yasir. Ammar ibn Yasir was among the first people to accept Islam. According to historians, he was number 7 to accept Islam. His father, Yasir, had come from Yemen. And they were from, if you remember, a few nights ago, when we mentioned the tribe of Saba, he was one of the descendants of the tribe of Saba. And they were originally from Yemen. So his father, along with a few of his brothers, they came from Yemen to Mecca in order to search for a brother that they had, a lost brother that they had. So when they arrived, they didn't find him. So two of the brothers, they decided to leave. But Yasir decided to stay in Mecca. He said, I'm going to stay here. I'm going to stay in the sanctuary. So as he stayed there, a man by the name of Abu Hudhayfa became his host. He would take care of him because he was an outsider. Now Yasir stayed in Mecca and he was a guest of Abu Hudhayfa. After time passed, Abu Hudhayfa offered to marry Yasir to his female servant Sumayya. He said, since you are staying, since you decide to live here, then marry my servant Sumayya. And Sumayya was known as a believer from the start. She was a great woman. So Yasir married Sumayya, and from this marriage, Ammar ibn Yasir was born. And Sumayya was a woman of dark color. And that's why Ammar ibn Yasir, just like Salman al-Muhammadi, and even like Abu Dharr al-Ghifari, faced racial discrimination because he was of darker color. Now, of this marriage again, Ammar ibn Yasir was born. And Ammar was a very virtuous man from the days that he was a young man. And he was born in Amul Fil, the year of the elephant, where, if you are familiar with the story, Abraha, the dictator of Yemen, at that time he had built a Kaaba of Abyssinia, I'm sorry. He had built something like a Kaaba, and he wanted people to come and worship in the same way that they would worship at the Kaaba in Mecca. So he brought an army of elephants in order to destroy the Kaaba in Mecca. That year, it is said the Prophet was born. Ammar ibn Yasir was also born in that year. And when he passed away, many years later, he was 94 years old during the Battle of Siffin. Okay, so when he was born and when he was raised in this environment, historians say that he didn't take the religion of polytheism. Not once did he worship an idol. And in fact, historians narrate conversations that he had with his father where he would tell his father, my dear father, why is our tribe worshiping idols? What is so special about these idols? Can they give? Can they take? Can they protect themselves? So every time his father would speak to him, he would tell him, my dear son, where are you getting these questions from? Where are you getting these ideas from? Are you being divinely inspired, or is someone tossing you these questions? He says, no, these are mere questions that I have. You know, I'm a sane man. This is normal questions, you know, not challenging anything. So his father would hint to him. He would tell him, I know what you're getting at, and I have the same beliefs as you. But at that time, people could not say what their beliefs were. They could not outright say, we don't want to worship the idols, out of fear for their life, because the idols were everything at that time to the polytheists. The idols are the ones that blessed them on a day-to-day basis. When people would come to Mecca in order to perform their business, the idols, it was out of the blessing of the idols. If they had children, it was out of the blessing of the idols. The idols were everything. They fed them, they clothed them. So they couldn't challenge them outright. However, they themselves did not worship. Now, when the Prophet was ordained, And Ammar knew about this. Ammar himself did not outright go to the Prophet and accept the message right away. It is said that he himself would worship in his own home. And the first person to establish a masjid where Allah was worshipped alone was Ammar ibn Yasir. He did so in his own home. His home was the first masjid in Islam in Mecca. So as he was praying one day, it is said that Zayd ibn Thabit, who at that time was the adopted son of Rasulullah, he came to the door, he came knocking. And his mother, Ammar, the mother of Ammar, Sumayyah, she opened the door. So she found him, she said, you know, Salaamu Alaikum, Ahlan wa Sahlan, what are you doing here? He said, I am here for Abu Yaqvan. That was the title of Ammar ibn Yasir. So he comes out and he takes him to the Prophet. He meets with the Prophet and it is there that he accepts Islam among the first people. Now he goes back to his people, he goes back to his parents without mentioning that he is a Muslim. He goes back to them and he talks to them, he speaks to them. He tells him again, these idols, they cannot benefit you. These idols cannot protect themselves. How are they going to protect you? Until finally, they accepted Islam themselves. And his parents were the first two people to give up their lives for the message of Islam. Once more than one person began to accept this message, the tribal elders began to realize this and they didn't approve. Abu Sufyan, Abu Lahab, Abu Jahl, the leaders of Quraysh, they couldn't have someone threaten their polytheistic values. So they rounded them up in a group one day and they began to punish them one by one. And Ammar and Yasir and Sumayyah, the parents of Ammar, were the first two people to give up their lives. Very old people at that time. And the story is narrated in detail, we won't go into detail, but Abu Jahl was the man who punished them himself. He rounded them up, and they would use whips on them, they would use rocks on them, they would lay them on the ground and they would push very heavy boulders on them in order to crush their bones and in order to, you know, crush their inside. The worst forms of torture and torment. And every time they would punish them, they would tell them, what are your beliefs? They wanted them to mention the names of their idols. And every time they would punish them, they would mention the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They would mention their monotheistic beliefs. Until it says that Abu Jahl, he lost it. You know, he tried everything that he could, he lost it. So he took a knife to the mother of Ammar and he began to stab her all over until she died. And then he went to his father and he began to beat him. And he had everyone beat him until they died. His parents, they died. In front of the eyes of Ammar, Ammar himself was whipped and he was beaten and he was tortured. And these were the first two people to give their lives for the Islam. When the Prophet saw this, when he came by, when he saw this, there was no one there to defend. When the Prophet saw this, he told them that you are now in heaven. He took them in his arms, he cradled them, and he said, you are now in heaven, you are now in a better place. So his parents were the first two people to give their lives for Islam. And he became a very loyal companion. And he was truthful. And the Prophet testified to his truthfulness. Aisha, the wife of the Prophet, she says that I heard Rasulullah say the following, that whenever Ammar is given a choice, he always chooses that which is right, so follow him. It's ironic because one day a man came to her and he was cursing Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, and Ammar, both of them. So she says to him that, as for Ali ibn Abi Talib, say that what you wish. This is an authentic hadith. Say what you wish. But as for Ammar, do not curse him, because the Prophet said that if he is ever given two choices, he always chooses the right one. So Ammar chooses the right choice according to the testimony of the Prophet. This is why we should not insult him. What about Ali ibn Abi Talib? Where were you from the hadith of the Prophet about Ali ibn Abi Talib, all his merits and all his virtues? So Ammar was a great person. Ammar was one of the closest people to the Prophet. And Ammar gave his life defending Rasulullah. He gave his life defending the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Now what happened after the life of the Prophet? Ammar was one of the people who decided not to pledge allegiance until Amir al-Mu'mineen pledged allegiance. And he was one of the only people, the handful, the few, who attended the funeral procession of Fatima al-Zahra, alayhi salam. Fatima had said to Amir al-Mu'mineen during the last few days of her life that do not allow anybody to attend my funeral except for a handful of people. This man had the privilege of attending the funeral procession of Fatima al-Zahra, alayhi salam. Now what happened? How did he die? And why is it important to know how he died? The reason why it's important to know how he died is because Rasulullah, according to all schools of thoughts, and this is an authentic hadith, this is a hadith which is undisputed. Rasulullah, see, people say that after the martyrdom of Rasulullah, it was unclear. That Rasulullah left the religion of Islam for people to decide on. And that there was misguidance, and that people amongst themselves, they chose who the leadership shall go to, and this is what Rasulullah wanted. There were no signs at all. Rasulullah did not leave behind a will. He did not leave behind anything. However, we find that Rasulullah, not only did he leave behind a will for his people, but he left behind signs so that in case people did not hear him directly, that Ali ibn Abi Talib is my successor, he left behind signs so that people could distinguish between truth and falsehood. What do I mean by this? Take the example of Ammar. The Prophet said about Ammar, that, O Ammar, those who will kill you shall be a rebellious group. تَقْتُلُكَ الْفِئَةُ الْبَاغِيَةُ Those who murder you shall be a rebellious group. Rebellious meaning what's... meaning that they are outside the fold of Islam. They are outside the fold of Islam, those that shall kill you. So this idea that Ammar ibn Yasir would be killed by a rebellious group became popular and common among the companions. Everybody knew this, and it was undisputed. Those who disputed the legitimacy of the Khilafah, and I'll mention some of the companions, during the Battle of Safin, they did not participate until they saw Ammar ibn Yasir was killed. That's it. It was clear for them. They knew, according to the hadith of Rasulullah, that these people are rebellious because they killed Ammar ibn Yasir. So how was he killed? During the Battle of Safin, as I mentioned. During the Battle of Safin, which took place in an area known as Safin, today it is in northern Syria, the area which is known as Ar-Raqqa. Ar-Raqqa, which is under the control of these very pleasant people today. That area is known as As-Saffin. And who was killed in Safin? Many companions. Thousands of companions. From both sides. People on the other side thought that they were doing good by fighting against Ali ibn Abi Talib. Do you know why? Because Muawiyah was such an expert at convincing people that he was right and the Imam was wrong. He had brainwashed people. Brothers and sisters, what do we learn from Muawiyah and from Yazid and from their likes, is that falsehood can be sugar-coated. It can be made to look like the truth. Falsehood is not always easy to recognize. So when you're faced with truth and falsehood, it's not always going to be easy. That's why the Imam, alayhi salam, during the Battle of Yemen, he says, اعرف الحق تعرف أهله وعرف الباطل تعرف أهله. He says, know what truth is, and you will know who is good. And then know what falsehood is, and you will know who is false, who is evil. But this truth and falsehood is not easy to recognize. It's very hard to recognize. Because falsehood could be sugar-coated to make it look like the truth, as was the case with Muawiyah, and Imam Hassan, and Yazid, and Imam Hussein. And truth can be made to sound unpopular and unwanted, as was the case. Now what happened? Why was Safin even fought? Muawiyah by that time had become the semi-autonomous ruler of Damascus. He had become governor during the time of Umar ibn Khattab, and it took him about 15, 20 years to completely solidify and consolidate his rule. By the time it got to the end of Uthman, that's it. He was a semi-autonomous khalifa. Now why did he want to fight against Amir al-Mu'mineen? The same reason why the people before him fought the Battle of Yemen. The blood of Uthman. The blood of Uthman was one of the most controversial topics at the time. Who was Uthman killed by? Today, if you ask people who killed Uthman, you will get a million different answers. This person says it was this person. That person says it was Fulan. No one wants to take responsibility. If you read history, it's clear who it was. If you read history, it is crystal clear who it was. However, nobody wants to take responsibility. When he died, everyone became self-righteous. I am the one to call for his blood. I am the one to avenge his blood. And thousands of people were raised, and thousands of people were killed for the blood of Uthman. Now Muawiyah wanted to fight for the blood of Uthman. We have to avenge the blood of Uthman. Do you know how Uthman died? His house was sieged. And why was his house sieged? Because of his own policies. Because he had changed the sunnah of the Prophet so much that people were fed up. They were sick. He had made all of his cousins, who the Prophet had expelled from Mecca, he brought them all back and made each and every one of them a governor. Every time there was a conquest, he would give the spoils of war to his relatives. People were dying under his rule. And he didn't care. He didn't pay attention. It was all about him and his family. So the Muslims were fed up. They sieged him. For months, they were around his house. They wanted to go in and kill him. Amir al-Mu'mineen would send letters to him. He would advise him, change your ways, change your tactics. He was adamant about what he did, until all of a sudden, one day they broke into his house and they killed him. And they injured his wife. They severed her finger. She tried to protect her husband. They struck the sword, it severed her finger, and they killed him. So what happened? Umm al-Mu'mineen Aisha, she takes the bloody shirt of Uthman and she sends it straight to his cousin Muawiyah. Look at what happened. Look at what they did. And he takes this bloody shirt and he takes the severed finger and he puts it in the middle of the mosque in Damascus for weeks and for months, and every day he calls the blood of Uthman, the blood of Uthman, the blood of Uthman. And thousands of people, you know, when you see death in front of you, when you see the blood in front of you, emotionally, you become moved. At the same time, not only did he show them the blood-stained shirt and the amputated finger, he would spread poison. He would say, you know this man who is responsible for the death? Guess what? He doesn't even pray. Imam Ali alayhi salam is born in the Kaaba and he dies in the mihrab, but he doesn't pray. This man does this, this man does... So he poisoned their minds. That's how he got thousands of people to rise against Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imam Ali told him, you're fighting me for the blood of Uthman? Don't fight me. I'm the Khalifa. People have pledged allegiance to me here in Medina. Don't fight against me. Let the dust settle and we'll seek the blood of Uthman. We'll see who is truly responsible. He said no. Now when Uthman was killed, where was Muawiyah? He was in his home in Damascus. He sent an army. History records this. He sent an army. He said, go to Medina, but do not enter Medina. Sit outside of Medina. Camp outside of Medina. And no matter what happens, do not go inside Medina. Even if you hear of the death of Uthman, do not go inside. And he says to his governor, or he says to his military commander, he says, don't use the excuse that you see what I do not see, that maybe you understand some circumstances which I can't understand, that you'll enter Medina without my consent. He tells him that from here, Damascus, I can see everything. And I can hear everything. Don't worry about me. So the army comes, they sit outside of Medina, Muawiyah is killed, and they go back. They haven't fought. All they have done, they kill Uthman. Uthman is killed. And the army goes back to Muawiyah. They go back empty-handed. The only thing that they have is the bloody shirt of Uthman and the severed finger of his wife. So they fight against him. Now as they are participating in the battle, and this battle took thousands of lives. So many people who were great companions of Rasulullah, they lost their lives. Why? Out of this, out of the blood of Uthman. And it was not, I repeat, it was not a legitimate cause. If anyone was to avenge the blood of Uthman, it would be Imam Ali himself, because he was the Khalifa and that was his responsibility, not anybody else's. In this battle, Ammar ibn Yasir at that time was 94 years old. But he fought like a brave lion. He had learned from his master, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Historians narrate that as he went out into the battle, he began to admonish people. I was reading today in a detailed account of the battle. It was saying that people were affected by his words more than they were affected by his sword. The effect that it had on them was more than the effect of his sword, because of how eloquent he was, because of how determined he was. Now he went out into battle and he fought. Rasulullah had told him that, Ya Ammar, the last thing which you will consume is milk. That's the last thing you will consume before you pass away. So as he is entering the battle, and the battle is very intense, in the pinnacle of the battle he is injured. And he comes back to the tent, he wants some water, and they say that there is no water. He's trying to drink water in order to regain his strength. They tell him there is no water. At this point he realizes the prophecy of Rasulullah. When they give him the milk, he says, my dear Rasulullah had informed me that one day before I die, my last thing that I will consume is a cup of milk. And he consumed it before he passed away. When he passed away, this point in the battle, although thousands of people had died, this point shook the battle to its core. Because everyone on the battlefield was familiar with the hadith of Rasulullah, that he said to Ammar, O Ammar, you would be killed by a rebellious group. So they came out and they heard about the death of Uthman, they heard about the death of Ammar, they began to question themselves. They began to question themselves, what are we doing here? We're responsible for the death of Ammar. Rasulullah had told Ammar that you would be killed by a rebellious group. We cannot be responsible. They turn to Amr ibn al-As, the general. Amr ibn al-As, he recognizes this as well. He goes to Muawiyah. He says, Ya Muawiyah, we cannot deny this hadith. This is what Rasulullah said. So Muawiyah, this expert, he tells him, he says, go and tell them that it is true that Rasulullah said that, O Ammar, you will be killed by a rebellious group. But Ali ibn Abi Talib is the one that brought Ammar to battle. So he is the one that is responsible for his death. And people were you know, gullible enough to believe this. So that brought them back the support and they began to fight. The news came to Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib that they're saying that you are the one that is responsible. You are the rebellious group. He smiles. He says, if I am responsible for the death of Ammar, then Rasulullah is also responsible for the death of his uncle Hamza. Because he's the one that brought him into the battle of Uthman. Is this proper logic? It's not proper logic. It's twisted logic. Now when Muawiyah was losing the battle, finally he called for the Qur'ans to be raised on spears. And that's what caused the stalemate and that's what caused the arbitration. So Ammar ibn Yasir passed away fighting for the Prophet, for Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, against the rebellious group. And in his life, there is so much to be said about him. What proves that he was a faithful companion of Amir al-Mu'mineen was his actions and his sayings. It is said that during the time of Uthman, as I mentioned, Uthman was very generous with his family members. He was very generous with his own companions and his own relatives while other people were starving to death. It is said that after the conquest of North Africa, 1/5 of the spoils of war were given to Marwan ibn al-Hakam, one of the cousins of Uthman. So a group of believers, among them being Ammar, among them being al-Miqdad ibn al-Aswad, about 10 of them, of the companions, they wrote a letter. And this letter was to Uthman, condemning him and questioning him as to why he was favoring his people over other people, over other Muslims. So they all wrote the letter, they all signed, but Ammar delivered it alone to Uthman. Nobody else wanted to participate in delivering the letter. So Ammar enters upon Uthman and he gives him the letter. So Uthman looks at the letter and he acknowledges what is in it. He says, did you participate in writing this? He says, yes, I did participate in writing this. He says, why are you making requests? Or what are your requests? He says that you're favoring your family members over other people. You are changing the sunnah of Rasulullah. At that moment, Uthman loses it. And this is Ammar, not any normal person. Ammar, who the Prophet said that he would be killed by a rebellious group. The Prophet said that he always chooses right. The Prophet said that he is a man who the heaven looks forward to. Uthman orders his cronies, his family members, to begin beating Ammar. And they fall upon him just for questioning why he was favoring his family members above other people. They began to beat him. They gang up on him. Uthman himself, the history says that he participated in the beating of Uthman. And they begin to kick him, and they begin to beat him, and they begin to punch him until he loses consciousness. And for 3 days, he is unconscious. He was taken to the home of Salama, the loyal wife of the Prophet, in order to be taken care of. So it is well known that he was a critic of Uthman. It is well known that he did not participate in the leadership after the martyrdom of Rasulullah. It is well known that he was a critic of Banu Umayyah. These were the companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Salman al-Muhammadi, same thing. Abu Dhar al-Ghifari, same thing. So when people ask us, the question that why are you critical of Fulan and why are you critical of Fulan? Tell them I walk in the footsteps of Ammar ibn Yasir. I am walking in the footsteps of Abu Dhar al-Ghifari. I am walking in the footsteps of Salman al-Muhammadi. When they tell you where are the Shia and who are the Shia and the Shia are a deviant group, tell them no. Rasulullah referred to these people as the Shia. Ammar ibn Yasir, Abu Dhar al-Ghifari, Salman al-Muhammadi, al-Miqdad ibn al-Aswad, these men who embodied and manifested the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam. How many people could reach their level? Can we reach their level? Sometimes we speak about reaching the levels of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, whether, you know, we are good enough to reach their level. Ask yourself, am I good enough to reach the level of the companions of Ahlul Bayt before the Ahlul Bayt themselves? So these are a few of the companions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam. And inshallah, tomorrow, most likely being the last night of Ramadan, we will continue this subject a little bit further. The purpose behind this, brothers and sisters, is to just familiarize ourselves a little bit with the companions of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam, the original people who were referred to as Shia. If we refer to ourselves as Shia, we say we are the Shia, let us understand the lives of the first people who were referred to as Shia. And it was not coincidental because they came from a certain country, because they came from a certain background. No, each one of them came from a certain background. Abu Dha came from Ghifar, Salman came from Persia, this man came from Yemen. They were all from different backgrounds. And Rasulullah referred to them as Shia, not because of their backgrounds, but because they had certain attributes. What are those attributes? What are those attributes that we can assimilate with? So we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to allow us to be among those who walk in the footsteps of the Ahlul Bayt. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to allow us to be among those who honor the companions of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to bless us and reward us and forgive us and have mercy upon us in this holy month, inshallah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. اللهم اغفر للمؤمنين والمؤمنات والمسلمين والمسلمات الأحياء منهم والأموات تابع بيننا وبينهم بالخيرات إنك مجيب الدعوات إنك قاضي الحاجات إنك على كل شيء قدير برحمتك يا أرحم الراحمين وصلى الله وسلم على سيدنا محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين.